This episode is sponsored in part by Thousand Eyes. Thousand Eyes gives you visibility, insights, and actionable intelligence into user experience from every user to every application over any network, so you transform your WAN, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experiences in the cloud and on-premises. Try Thousand Eyes for free at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and snag a fun t-shirt. Thousand Eyes. Thrive in a connected world.
Today on the Packet Pushers Weekly Podcast... wait a second. You know why we call it the weekly show? Because originally this show was just called Packet Pushers, right? Way back in May 2010. But then we added all these other channels to create a podcast network. And so how do we identify the original show? You know, this one that you're listening to now. Well, we're so clever that we called it the Packet Pushers Weekly Show. And branding experts the world over groaned. Anyway, on this episode of the Packet Pushers Weekly Show, we have another addition to the Future of Networking series where we chat up prominent folks making things happen in networking, get their take on where the packets are flowing over the next several years. And our guest today is Kyle Mestery. Kyle is well known to many corners of the networking community, including the open source community. He recently rejoined Cisco as a distinguished engineer. Kyle, welcome back to Packet Pushers. And we were chatting in email about this show. You've got a lot of things on your mind. And one of the things we were kind of kicking around before the we hit the record button, which was conferences. And you made the point that, geez, you could be on the road almost every week of the year if you wanted to, going to some conference or another. And Greg and I have been, we don't travel nearly that much. We got kind of burnt out on it over the last couple of years and are trying to cut back. Have you've been on the road a lot?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. It's totally gotten to overload. And I think, you know, the broader conferencing industry, open source, vendor conferences, all these things, those have been obviously exploding over the years. But then in the last year and a half, 2 years, you really saw open source networking start to explode, you know, as the ONF and the Linux Foundation started to kind of ingest a lot of these projects, you know, build foundations around them and conferences. It got to the point where, you know, you could be going to whatever con almost every week, and it definitely gets exhausting, I think. You know, I think part that's almost part of the reason that the Linux Foundation kind of started this whole LFN, the Linux Foundation Networking project or kind of umbrella thing, right, was to kind of pull a lot of these in and realize, hey, maybe we don't need a separate conference for every little open source project. Maybe we should just have one, you know, and I think that's what they're trying to do with the Open Networking Summit. So you know, maybe relief is in sight.
It was like for a while there, it was like every other week there was a new foundation and that had been created with a governance board and, you know, and we used to joke on the Network Break podcast, which is the other the news channel that we sort of I'm a part of. We used to joke, which foundation did we have set up this week? And sure enough, there'd be a foundation set up every week for a while.
Oh yeah, it was like foundation as a service, right? I vaguely remember joking about that on Twitter a year ago. So
yes, it really was.
So in the context of open source networking, Kyle, with all of these conferences, when you go to these events, what do they seem to achieve much in your mind?
I think a lot of the well certainly I think they do, right? Because I think first of all, it's really great. The one thing that's good about all the conferences is it obviously gives people a chance to be able to speak, to be able to say what's on their mind. Both veterans that have done a lot of presentations, but also new people. And I think that's the good thing about conference overload is that there's a lot more opportunities for people to get a chance to talk. But I think the real value with a lot of these conferences is actually like the hallway conversations, is the chance to get some FaceTime with people, to be able to do that sort of thing as well. So it's kind of like a little of both, right? It's good and it's bad.
Now you mentioned open source networking and a lot of the conferences built around that and the Linux Foundation and the newly formed LFN and so on. Is that the future for the industry broadly? And when I asked that in the context of some guy on Reddit who posted that, oh my gosh, my manager is going to force Cumulus and white box switching down our throats and it's going to be awful and you know, and so on. And we read this whole diatribe about how miserable his life was going to be because it wasn't a quote-unquote brand name solution like Cisco or Juniper or something like that. Does open source have is that part of the future broadly, or is it going to remain a kind of a niche player for the hyperscalers with specific solutions?
Oh my God, they're going to give me some Page clothes. I won't be able to wear my Gucci. If it's not Gucci, it's going to be just so bad. All my friends are going to hate me. Oh my God, Tajay! I read that. You know, post. That was my immediate reaction.
I think that's spot on, and that should be it. You know, I think the reality is probably somewhere in between, right? And one way we can look at this is let's take a look at the Linux Foundation's Open Switch project, not to be confused with Open vSwitch, right? This is Open Switch. So you take a look at Open Switch. You know, I was part of HP when that was kind of open sourced and we had some people on board. It was a majority kind of HP effort to kind of say, hey, we're going to like open source a network operating system and we're going to develop it in the open. We're going to take people in. So, you know, they went on that journey for about a year or so. And then, you know, they pulled back for, you know, for whatever reason they had. You know, for a while you saw SnapRoute come in there and they were going to try to do something in there. And Dell, it seems like Dell is now taking that over. But the reality is, and I wrote a blog post on this, it's very difficult to attract people to develop a network operating system in the open like this. And that was the problem that HP had. And in fact, when they pulled out and Dell kind of, you know, put in a whole new version of OpenSwitch, some of the developers in the open tried to fork this into LibreSwitch, and that died on the vine as well. And the reality is, you know, it's kind of like, part of the problem is, you know, the silicon problem, you know, who's going to be able to buy these from a hobbyist perspective? You know, are you going to be able to get the license to you know, touch all the silicon and do what you need? And how much interest do you have? And I think this goes back to the whole Gucci discussion, right? You know, do you want to mingle with that stuff or do you kind of want to buy it and operate it? And no one's been able to find that balance outside of the hyperscalers.
Yeah, well, I think the hyperscalers have, I think there's definitely a sense of, there's a lot of skin in the game. You know, for them, their whole business bets on their data centers. And I think enterprises, on the other hand, say that the whole thing, you know, they bet their business on their computers, but actually they don't mean it. Because they're you know, data centers can go down for a couple of days and everybody goes like, well, that's really bad. And everybody gets upset, but nobody gets fired. You know, the business doesn't halt, doesn't die completely just because their computers stop working. So it's like a common fallacy to pretend, oh, we're 24/7 and we're technology centric, but it's actually a flat out hypocritical lie.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other challenge is, you know, finding the other challenge here is finding the developers and giving them time. I mean, like you said, the hyperscalers, they're betting all their business on this. So of course they're going to have a development team for all sorts of this these types of things. I mean, in addition, they may be doing like silicon and even further down the stack. But you know, is the typical enterprise going to do that? I mean, if they can get somebody to write Ansible automation for their scripts, they're probably doing pretty well. So
now you mentioned a second ago that it was hard to find developers to attract developers to a NOS project, and I think that would be something that a developer would be like, oh, that sounds cool, right? A network operating system or you know some aspect of it. So why is it hard to attract devs?
You know, that's actually been the million-dollar question because OpenSwitch tried it and they really just did have a problem. Now, what was interesting was one of the only people who actually was working on OpenSwitch and I'll have to go grab his name, but I forget the gentleman's name. But you know, he brought up the point that an open source network operating system or NOS that's actually been successful over the years is OpenWRT. And I think that is because, first of all, it targeted you know, a hardware category that was easily accessible to a lot of people. So I think that's what got it a lot of exposure and was able to get developers in, right? Because it's targeting small, you know, home routers.
There's not a lot of people who can afford a $10,000 white box switch just to play with.
That's exactly right. And that's it, right? And so you got to be able to work at a place where you can do that. And I think the other problem, and this is something that you see in a lot of these enterprises is, sure, you have developers that maybe want to work on this NOS and that, but unless they're also the operations team is very different from the development team. And they kind of have a history of wanting to operate what they know, you know, and they'll live with those warts. They know those warts. They don't maybe know the warts on some of the open source stuff.
I felt there was a few things with the OpenSwitch project that didn't make sense to me. One was the expectation that it would be immediately successful. So when I spoke to the folks over at Dell, they sort of thought that if they dropped their, like, hello, we've got this NOS. And they sort of like dropped a big bucket that's full of turds inside of it, inspected the flies to come around and to love it and to really want it and to lap it up. And the reality was that I don't think many people in the market were ready for the idea of contributing to developing a network operating system. It was too early. And to, you know, not that you couldn't find developers. I don't think most people even realized that it was possible at the time that the OpenSwitch project was running.
Right. And I think that's part of it as well. And I think there was some confusion initially around it because of you know, it was named close to Open vSwitch. And then it was, you know, well, what hardware are you going to support here? Who else is involved? All of that. And then, you know, and then it turns out that that what kind of happened in the background was, you know, Open Network Linux, which Big Switch has been, you know, kind of working on for a long time, has, it seems like on the ONF side, and certainly maybe on the hyperscaler side, there's been some coalescing around that, with the outlier being Microsoft and Sonic and their own Debian-based operating system underneath.
So, and I think the other thing here, too, is that back then Broadcom had closed SDKs. So it wasn't like I could suddenly jump up and start writing code unless I'd signed up to Broadcom's, well, at that time, it was quite a strict, very rigidly controlled, very unfriendly non-disclosure agreement about getting access to the SDK, and that could only be done if you were working for a very big vendor.
That's exactly right, and that certainly has been part of the problem as well. You know, what can you do? You're not going to be able to, as an individual developer, engage in that sort of a license with Broadcom, nor do they even really probably want you to. So I think that also prevented it.
Yeah, I always felt that Cisco didn't want Broadcom to open the SDK, because if it did, it would disrupt their business. And there was sort of like some backwards, you know, there was a pulling backwards and forwards from different parts of Cisco that wanted to be open, and another part that wanted to have the ASIC for itself and didn't want anybody to be able to contribute code because that might disrupt their product plans and their businesses. And then Broadcom itself is not a very open company. It's not inherently... you know, willing to share everything that, or to share knowledge or to participate in open. It doesn't have any history of that per se. It likes to dominate a market and control it. And this idea of share. So there was a whole bunch of like negative incentives going on before open source finally ground them down. So another reason why I thought OpenSwitch was a little too early.
Yeah, exactly. And then you had, you know, and then it's interesting you brought up that Broadcom, you know, not as open as you might like. And you know, they, as long as they were kind of in front of their competitors on the ASIC front, they were happy to do that. But then you started to see, you know, other ASICs used in switches a bit come out. And I think that maybe is what forced them to do that as well. You know, they
saw Cavium come out with their Cavium X Blind, come out with an open, and Mellanox was publishing an open SDK for anybody. Just go and have it, you know.
Go and have it. Exactly.
Yes. And there was others too.
Definitely.
Kyle, as you look at the open source networking ecosystem, there's been so many projects. We've been talking and reminiscing about some of them here, OpenSwitch versus OpenVSwitch, for example. You mentioned Open Network Linux, which is kind of functioning at a little different layer. Maybe it's, are there some winners here? Are there some projects we can look at now as people that are going to want to consume these projects and begin building our own open networking stacks, projects that we can look at and go, okay, this is how I'm going to build my stack. I'm going to, you know, start with ONL, and then I'm going to layer on, et cetera. Is there, what are the winners you're seeing as you project out into the future?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I think, you know, I think if you look at this NAS space, I mean, from a hyperscaler perspective, from that perspective, it seems like ONL is really being at least used, evaluated for different things. And, you know, it appears like we're all going to have to wait a little bit towards the end of the year and early next year, you know, for Google to really open up the Stratum code so we can kind of see what's going on there. But, you know, from what we saw at the Open Compute Summit and some of the discussions at ONL, it appears like they're really trying to run a lot of this on Open Network Linux. And you know, if you think about it, that makes a ton of sense. And this is where, you know, ultimately focused, right? I mean, if you can get that base Linux layer, so it's going to interface to the hardware, it's going to do all the boring things that no one really wants to do around temperature sensors, fan sensors. It's going to program that underlying hardware and kind of make that something that no one has to do again. It's one place. That's actually a pretty big win. And that's what you kind of saw Google, Facebook, and Big Switch doing with putting different control planes on top of that. And so the interesting thing is, you know, the Stratum code, we can't really see it yet to see what's going on there. We will eventually, and we'll get to see that and kind of see what's going on there. So I think that'll be interesting to look out for in the second half of the year.
So position ONL, so someone who's, they've got a white box switch, what would they be doing with ONL, and then what would they need on top of it so that the people trying to build one of these things, the role of each component are clear in their minds?
Right. So I think you could picture ONL as really that base Linux operating system. That's what you're going to boot when you turn the switch on. It's going to come up just like Linux on a server, for example. And that's an interesting part. That's going to get it up. That's going to get it to recognize whatever ASIC you have in there. The interesting part is the control plane on top. Whether you want to do something traditional with BGP, you want to use like a BGP-based control plane to do something, or you want to do something more programmatic. Stratum's doing something like P4. And these are all pretty interesting things that are going to happen here, kind of moving forward, I think. And Stratum starts to almost take things into more of like a cloud-native way on these network operating systems. I mean, if you look at what ONL is doing, what OpenSwitch is doing, what Microsoft's doing with Sonic, a lot of it is still almost traditional NAS type of things, with a traditional ASIC and all this sort of stuff. You know, maybe down the road in a few years, we might be able to talk more cloud native, even on that NAS side, where, you know, instead of just running Linux, hey, maybe we're running something like Kubernetes down there, and we're scheduling, you know, pods down to your switch. And we're doing things like that. So
yeah,
right. So rather than Kubernetes networking today would be functioning at a higher layer where there's a container that's made to be a part of that Kubernetes network, and the NAT and whatever the policy might be is put in there. But you're talking taking it down a layer and putting that functionality into the switch itself, where Kubernetes would actually talk to the switch and make it participate in the network at that layer.
Right, exactly. That's something that would be interesting to take a look at, right? Being able to allow that so you could expose some of those resources, so that applications running on Kubernetes could consume them that way. You almost kind of build it in as part of that as part of like a service mesh, right? You can start to build in some of your switching components and some of these sorts of things. And where that becomes really interesting, I think, is when you start to think about NFV. Because if you look at where the industry has gotten to with NFV, right? It's almost like virtualization 1.0. And you got to start there. That's a good place, right? So a lot of the vendors, a lot of the companies have taken these network functions. They've wrapped them up as virtual machines. They run great on VMware. They run on KVM, whatever hypervisor you want. And you start to stitch things together this way. But when you start to step back a step and you start to look at some of the programmability you have, whether it's with something like P4, whether it's with something like FDIO or something like that, you say, maybe you could start to build some of these virtual network functions more programmatically. And then when you do that, hey, maybe now you could start to move them to a more cloud native operation and deployment way as well.
Okay. So in other words, rather than relying on BGP, OSPF, ISIS to stand up layer 3 adjacencies between network devices, that familiar way of standing up an IP fabric that most network engineers are familiar with, what if we take it back a step? We say, okay, forget those methods of a control plane, and instead, we're going to write code that integrates with an orchestration system that programmatically puts entries in the data plane effectively. P4, you've mentioned, was OpenFlow back in the day. It doesn't sound like you're talking about OpenFlow at all anymore. And would we be leaving BGP and so on behind, except for maybe like at the edges?
You know, honestly, like that's a great question. And I think if you start to look at how you might want to integrate this stuff with Kubernetes, I think you really leave that to the implementation underneath. And by the way, that's kind of like what that demo at Open Compute with ONL was about. You saw the Stratum stuff being pretty far looking in future, you know, all programmable, leaves all the traditional protocols perhaps behind. And then you saw, hey, you can still run BGP as well. So that's kind of what I envisioned for this as well, going forward with how you might move NFV to a more cloud native model. You could still use the old way of doing things.
So there's a couple of things here. One is switches today are mainframes. You can run anything on that switch you want as long as it was given to you by the vendor. And there's no choice. Your only choice is to select from one of 1400 commands about what you want to do, right? And they're all defined for you, which is comforting. You know, it's easy to know. It's easy to think you know what you're doing and to understand the impacts. But going forward, we don't want to be limited in the switch itself. We want to be able to run BGP sometimes. Other times, we want to run OpenR. Or maybe sometimes we actually just want to run directly load the forwarding table in the silicon with some direct capability. And then it's also not enough for the switch to just do forwarding, I think. When you talk about network functions, what you're saying is the switch or the router, the idea that there is a switch or a router and that they're two different things obviously is going to go away. But why not turn a switch or router straight into a load balancer? Maybe, you know, you've got a stream of traffic that's, you know, 10% of the traffic going through the box and you want to implement an L4 load balancer. Well, fire up a container on the switch, drop in something that's going to program the TCAM table to do L4 load balancing, and then program the flow straight into the TCAM, and boom, you've got yourself an edge load balancer in the switch. I mean, this is what the CDN companies are doing today. Cloudflare, for example, is moving in that direction.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And if you look, so there's a project that we've just started working on called Network Service Mesh, which kind of moves things in this direction. And it's exactly like what you're saying, Greg. It says, hey, we've got these service meshes for Kubernetes for standard applications. But what if we created like a network service mesh that had a similar concept and was able to plug in VNFs, maybe change to cloud native instead of virtual, but plug those types of things in and expose those resources. So when pods request them, we're able to supply them, and the implementation details can be underneath. It doesn't matter, like you said, if it's just BGP or if someone's implemented something way more advanced, right? You could do that sort of thing. So it's an interesting concept.
Yeah. And I think increasingly, so if you wanted me to say, where's this going to come into the enterprise, let me give you a hypothetical scenario. Let's say you're buying a Nutanix hyperconverged platform or a HPE hyperconverged, you know, whatever they're called this week. Cisco's got, you know, 20 different company partnerships that it's got a hyperconverged. And you get your servers and your network and your storage all comes as one, and you buy predefined rack-sized chunks of stuff, right? You're familiar with hyperconverged? Now,
exactly. Yep.
Now, those people might say, we're going, and in there, there'll be some sort of software that does network control. And one of those things is going to be load balancing. Now, do you go and buy an F5 licensed load balancer and, you know, pay for a license and then download it and report and set up a licensing server and blah, blah, blah? Or do you just go to the say to the customer, you know, we've got a simple L4 load balancer here, click here and we'll activate it. And that's a feature of our hyperconverged platform, is that we've got this software load balancer that uses the networking switch as a light. Or maybe there's no reason why you can't implement a firewall in a switch, right? Tracks, right. All you need is it's going to do some stateful tracking. So why not have a container in there that's going to do state tracking and program the TCAM directly?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's definitely, I like the idea of this kind of being part of a hyperconverged thing, because it really fits in with that model for sure.
Yeah.
But the other way to look at it too is, you know, you could do all of that in the switch, or you could do that on the edge as well. Yes. And really that is an implementation detail that the consumer
you can do it in the
exactly.
Yeah. You're saying in the virtual switch or
in the virtual case, switch. Yes.
Or in the case of the container in the operating system, well, the pseudo container edge, you know, the networking module in the container. So that's where Cilium comes in. So
yes.
Open vSwitch.
Right.
And
you could do it. You could do it in those things as well. You could do it, in user space and something like FDIO as well. You could do it in an accelerated NIC, a smart NIC or something like that. I mean, there's tons of different options here. But the beautiful thing is, if you think of it this way, and you look at what we're trying to do with this network service mesh, all of those details can be kind of hidden underneath, and the application is just consuming it. And the pods that are going to consume it, the pods that are going to advertise it. They can just implement it however they want. So
when you say service mesh, network service mesh, are you talking like what Istio and Trafic and?
That's right.
LinkedIn.
That's exactly right. Exactly. And that's where this idea kind of came from. And it said, well, let's try to move some of this to a more cloud native thing, because at the end of the day, if you look at a service mesh, it starts to look a lot like service chaining. Right, a networking concept that we're all kind of familiar with on that side, and service chaining is obviously how a lot of these VNFs are currently implemented. So what if we tried to move that concept of a service mesh, make a network service mesh that kind of works with Kubernetes and with these container management platforms to be able to allow that to work with some of these cloud native things.
Translate that concept for people that are used to middle boxes, though. I mean, almost so many people listening to the show right now live in the middle box world where they're routing things manually through some piece of hardware. They never got to the NFV phase, especially. And then you push it harder into service mesh, and people are trying to understand what the heck was this, would this even look like? Can you give us an overview?
Yeah, exactly. I think if you kind of step back and you look at maybe what NFV is trying to do, right? NFV fundamentally was all about virtualizing a lot of these network services. So instead of having to route things to hardware boxes that were going to implement these functions, and then, you know, add more hardware boxes as you need more capacity, it said, why don't we try to implement those as virtual machines running on a hypervisor somewhere and do that network functionality down there? So that was great. And like I said, that's a great first step. And then when you look at what service meshes are doing, service meshes evolved eventually to get this sidecar concept where your business logic was kind of removed from the whole service discovery, the routing of the traffic, load balancing, all of that. And if we look at what we could do with network service mesh, we could do something similar there as well, where now we could say, hey, you know, your application wants to consume an L3 service or something like that. And all we're saying with that is you're going to send packets that are L3 and you're going to receive packets that are L3. And then what you do with them down there is up to you. And that's where that implementation detail comes in.
The thing I love about service meshes is the idea of L3 forwarding is dead. Yeah, the only time you need to do layer 3 forwarding is when you're in the internet. After that, it's send it here, send it here. The L3 actually just becomes an app identifier almost in a service mesh.
Exactly. And I really think that service mesh, if you look at what that does, that really kind of offloads all of that functionality and lets the application developer really just focus on their business logic without having to mess with that. And it kind of moves a lot of that to the operator of the cluster as well, I think, which is also a good thing.
So what you're saying there is you want to see the service mesh abstracted. So instead of it being like a software only, product dependent, it's a set of standard functions and you can call them. And maybe some of those functions are instantiated as the network driver in a Kubernetes container. Some of them are instantiated as a vSwitch on a VM, and some of them are instantiated in hardware. It doesn't really matter because ultimately the primitives for all that are the same.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And you're just setting it up in your configuration file that you want to make sure that you get a pod that has that functionality that provides that. And then it doesn't matter, right? You're going to consume that. Kubernetes will schedule you somewhere where you have that functionality, where you have access.
I need to load balance across 15 containers. Do you load balance using a software-based service mesh? So you spawn 15 mesh instances on each container and then negotiate the connection training between them. Or maybe you hand it off to a vSwitch somewhere, and the vSwitch might be able to access a hardware NIC, and there's some L3, L4, L7 load balancing being done, you know, pre-container, or maybe even further upstream at the top of the rack, there's a switch. And as the flows come in, you're actually using some sort of TCAM feature or, you know, switch hardware feature to do L3, L4 load balancing because that makes sense for some reason.
Because, right. Yeah. And in this particular case, remember, we're looking at moving some of these VNFs over into this type of an environment. And one of the reasons you're looking at doing that if you're an operator is you like the fact that Kubernetes provides you things like auto scaling. It'll scale things up. It's going to make sure that if something happens to that virtual function, it's going to restart it. You get all of that functionality with it. And this allows you to kind of stitch that traffic together as well and indicate where it goes.
Yeah, it feels, Kyle, like this, in certain circumstances, this does replace service chaining. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
The service chaining, we were going hop by hop, tunneling typically, tagging in some cases, NSH. It doesn't seem like any one thing took hold. It was all kind of, this is our solution and it works for us. This kind of feels like, especially in the context of bringing orchestration into it, would be the way forward. This is just the way to go.
I think so. It seems like it's a pretty solid way forward. And I think one thing you can look at is you can look at a lot of the operators, the traditional network people. You know, Kubernetes doesn't really have the concept of things that we're all familiar with, right? Like IP addresses, subnets, ports, interfaces, all of these sorts of things. And frankly, do we all think it should? I suspect that the Kubernetes community doesn't really think that's the case, right? But the reality is a lot of the operators may want to use it, and they're confused as to how they can take that knowledge that they have, these things that they're used to running, and get them to work in that infrastructure.
It's going to be interesting to see the result of that, because if you've got, when you get into the container networking world, They just want to instantiate a container and for data to come and go from the container. So they've got no care, no wisdom, no insight. They don't care how the networking works inside of there. And yet, as soon as you leave the Kubernetes environment, all of the legacy networking concepts that we have, well, they're not legacy, but all of the networking principles that we have to sustain and maintain, subnets, routing, switching, all that sort of stuff, suddenly snaps back into focus. When? Like, the data has to come off an internet connection, which is all. And there's a real tension there. This is my concern here is, we talked about OpenSwitch as a NOS coming too early and the market conditions weren't quite right. The question I have about Kubernetes is, are we pushing into things and the market's not ready for them? There are people out there who are still struggling with the idea of doing network path operations with BGP instead of OSPF. And we're over here doing
that. That gives you a state of where, exactly. Yeah. This, how far advanced is this, right? Like, is this, how bleeding edge is this? And there's no doubt it's bleeding edge because what is the adoption rate of Kubernetes in the enterprise at this point? I don't know, but I got to believe it's low, right? It's probably small, on the up.
Yeah.
Vanishingly small. Exactly. So this is This is
a handful of percentage, a handful of percent of people would be able to spell it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So this is definitely pushing things forward. But I think it's interesting, like Greg, like you were just talking about with the WAN use case or whatever. So if you look at the early proposal that we have around this network, service mesh stuff, one of the things we're saying is, in your YAML file for your application, we're proposing like you could do something like set up a channel, right? And the channel, we don't want to overload the ports, but a channel will have a payload type. So you could put different things in there like IP, Ethernet, MPLS, whatever you want in there. And then we're also saying we're going to have a protocol in there as well, which will focus on what is carried over the channel. So, and that's it. We don't need to know the addressing. We don't need to know that sort of stuff, but that will allow it to get, like in your use case with the WAN, send it over to a device that can do that. And then from there, now you can send it wherever you want. So it's kind of pushing these concepts in, and a lot of this is coming from the service providers, right? Because they kind of want this. So there is always this tension between kind of the service providers and what they want to do, and kind of
the service providers aren't all seeing, all knowing, gods of networking. They're usually idiots and fools and dreamers who think that they've got a way forward. And
I'm not sure. You got to tell us what you really think. It didn't,
I was being polite, being nice. Like, there's a lot of people who work in the telco space who, get very wedded to a particular thing, or they see reasons why things won't work. Or now there is definitely, at the same time, we are seeing momentum around telcos. Like, look at what AT&T's done with Danos and DNOS and ONAP and Cord and, supporting all of these projects and throwing real money and real resources at getting. So there is some signs of change, but at the same time, there are people in the carrier space who are saying, sure, we want NFV and we want to be able to, but they don't even know how to bill it. They don't know how to OSS it. They don't know, would you really trust a telco? This is a telco who takes 3 months to install a circuit and to light up a bandwidth between an A and a B point to actually be able to instantiate a firewall and keep it running 24/7, 365. It's very difficult for me to imagine that a telco is competent enough because they're so big, right? Any company that gets sufficiently large becomes incredibly dumb. And the bigger it gets, the dumber it gets. And so it really comes down to, how do you manage these services? How do you software define? What is the platform that you use to say, customer packet pushes wants a firewall and it has to be deployed at this endpoint and it has to have these rules and it has to have a management platform and they have to have visibility and the billing for it and who's gonna make the firewall? So now we have to have a portal to put the firewall rules in. That is a not insignificant challenge.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I agree for sure. And all of that is true, and that's always been the case. So maybe what this is allowing us to do is to separate that, all of that configuration, away from the application. So imagine the telco has people that are writing these applications for their customers, perhaps, or maybe they're even allowing customers to deploy these types of things, so that you can separate all of that firewall functionality in your example And the application can just consume that. And if they want to just implement the firewall exactly as they have, and it's taken them a week to set that up, you know, then so be it. I mean, yeah. they can do that, or they can move to something newer, but it kind of at least allows them to move in that direction, I think.
In theory, the question is whether a company that large and which has got every incentive not to build virtual services can.
Yeah, definitely. And no doubt all of this is pretty future looking and pretty far off in the future. But I think there is some hunger and some interest for things to move in this direction. And the biggest problem with all of this has always been, you know, a lot of the telco requirements are different. So trying to help shape their requirements so that they can be exposed in some of these open source projects is kind of an interesting way to look at it. Experience.
Now you get down to the CTO office dreamer who thinks this would be the right way to do things. And then the CTO office goes down to the operations team and they just look at him and go like, you what?
Let's pause the podcast for a moment to tell you about today's sponsor, ThousandEyes. You like it or not, your organization is embracing the cloud, and that might be great for the business, but for network architects and IT ops teams, it can be a service delivery nightmare. Why? Well, you're depending on cloud providers, ISPs, and third-party apps for business-critical services. And even though you don't control those networks, you do own the service delivery, which means if performance is bad, people are going to come looking for you. And this is where ThousandEyes can help. You can take advantage of ThousandEyes agents across the cloud within your enterprise all the way down to the endpoint. These agents actively monitor network behavior and topologies and how they affect application performance. With ThousandEyes, you can correlate multiple layers of performance data from L2 to L7, including BGP routing and DNS, to quickly identify problem areas and dramatically reduce your mean time to repair. You can pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. And you don't have to keep all this intelligence to yourself. You can easily share events, metrics, and dashboards with your vendors and customers so that you can collaborate to resolve problems faster. Now, ThousandEyes also aggregates anonymized real-time data from a collective dataset so they can generate insights about large-scale issues across the internet, including their severity and breadth, as well as likely root cause. Now, if all that sounds good to you, here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Try ThousandEyes for free at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. And while you're there, get yourself a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. That's thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Manage every network like it's your own. ThousandEyes. Thrive in a connected world. And now, back to the podcast.
Let me flip the conversation in a little different direction here. We've been talking about service providers. Okay, well, what about enterprise then? So a lot of the technology here has been driven by the flexibility requirements, the coming of 5G, being able to compose services on the fly for businesses as they onboard to the service provider network. But what about enterprises consuming these technologies? And so the context is this. Going back to that guy who was just all upset because of, you know, his boss thought he was going to buy Cumulus, bringing open networking into the enterprise seems like it should be networkers understand how networking works, and this is just a little bit different of a way to do it, and gosh, we save a lot of money, but yet that's not the equation. So does this technology flow into the enterprise, or is most of it just going to kind of stay parked in service providers?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, because that's always the challenge. And I think you could think of it as a few different ways, right? So if your enterprise is using, you know, traditional VMware stack and some of this, it may be hard to get some of the open source software on the edge. So maybe you look at exposing some of that open source software either in your networking stack. You look at maybe doing either a white box switch or running open software there. That's another option. Now, if you're looking at, obviously, if you're looking at something like Red Hat, whether it's, you know, their virtualization product, OpenStack, whatever, you already have that kind of open software on the edge at this point. So that kind of moves you in that direction. And then the next place you might look at this is maybe the next insertion point for this is with Kubernetes. If the enterprise is moving to Kubernetes, that kind of provides another entry point for open software, especially on the networking side as well.
One thing you didn't say here is cost is going to win. And when businesses start to realize they can save significant dollars on CapEx and OpEx by moving to an open model, they'll make the change, which of course we've argued against here in this point for a while, because it doesn't seem like enterprises have much problem spending tons and tons of money on their infrastructure. But But I mean, but cost really is a factor here, though. There is big dollars to be saved moving to this model.
I think it is. There's definitely big dollars, but I think a lot of it also comes down to fundamentally what your operations team is used to operating. And there's a lot of inertia there or lack of inertia just because of that, I think. And that's something that people always kind of factor out. You know, if you've written some automation platform for your Cisco switches or your Arista switches or your Juniper routers and that, and you have that working and that's in place, and then someone comes in and says, hey, we got this white box thing here that does this and has these APIs. You know, from a cost saving perspective, higher up the executive chain, you might be saying, hey, this is great. Now I can start buying these. But then you go down to the operations team and they say, wait, we invested all this time and we've got this automated and this is all working. Now we have to go do all that again. And what's the benefit to us here? So it's kind of a struggle.
Yeah. And it's a two-edged sword there too, for those people, because they will, sure, it's new technology. Let's install the new technology. There'll be some people on the team that would be excited about that opportunity to learn, but yet there's always risk, because if it doesn't work like we expect, or there's some, you know, special command, we're going to have to learn about the hard way, and there's going to be downtime until we figure out what that is. They don't also want to catch the blame. And it does seem like IT practitioners, those people in the trenches building networks, catch the heat when something blows up. And so I see that side of it as well. Although on the other hand, it does feel like there's too much resistance, just because you learned a particular CLI and that's the CLI, you know, you don't want to shift to anything else, which from my perspective is a little frustrating. I mean, are you a networker or are you someone who learned how to run commands?
60 to 70% of industry is somebody who learned how to run commands. That's a common problem that I feel in the whole, like, just to cover that off as to why I make that statement, that there are a lot of people, so-called network professionals, who went and did a CCNA course, which at the heart of it is 160 hours of study time, of classroom time, and then they went and passed an exam. So let's say they did a total of 300, for every hour in the classroom, they did an hour at home. So 320 hours, and they're now classed as a professional. If you're a carpenter or an electrician, you go through a four-year apprenticeship, you would spend 24 weeks out of that four-year period in a classroom studying the theoretical, but that's 960 hours. So in networking, we do one third the amount of study that an electrician does, but you have a whole different sense of how important you are in the scheme of things. If your only knowledge set is CCMP, you're probably a fumbling incompetent by most career standards.
Or a politer way to put that is, you're a pretty good operator, but maybe not a great engineer or architect.
It's a foundation you really need to keep moving, you know, even more.
It's tough. And you know, the industry's been talking about this for at least 5 years. I remember giving talks, you know, 6 years ago, 5 years ago on what future network operators should look like, you know, and it's not, and it's a struggle, right? Because I think a lot of the network operators hear this and they think, oh, I'm going to have to be a Python programmer now, or I'm going to have to, you know, learn this language or this automation tool. And I think it is more gray than it is black or white there. No one is saying that everyone has to become a programmer, but I think adding that tool to your tool belt is going to be helpful moving you forward. And it's going to make you maybe less of a, you know, quote unquote CLI jockey and more able to examine problems from a different angle if you have more tools, right?
We should put this into perspective. The purpose of the CLI is to limit what you can do with the box. The idea behind the command line was it was the only way that we could think of to configure the box 20 years ago. And then following that, it made sure that you didn't have too many choices. So it was in the vendor's interest to keep you as dumb as possible and restrict the flexibility that you had. And it was even in our own interest, because networking had so little information, so little training, so little knowledge to be shared, that we just stuck with basic, simple things that didn't need a lot of expertise or a little competency to operate. And the command line is a propagate. It's not an advanced feature. It's a restrictive feature that prevents you from doing useful things, because you can't do things that aren't specifically otherwise allowed in the CLI.
And you know how we know it's restrictive, Greg? Remember, there's always the hidden or the secret commands, aren't there?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that people don't know a whole lot
about. And this whole discussion kind of loops back to what we were talking to earlier, where, you know, if you start to look at exposing these network devices, whether they're switches, routers, firewalls, or whatever, and making them more general purpose compute engines to run things, and tie them into more of your management framework, it really makes it so that you can use them maybe in a way that fits your application much better. Now, again, that's always been a problem as well, because you look at like what the hyperscalers are doing in that, and they've built everything they have is kind of custom built for their exact way of doing things. And a lot of that maybe doesn't map so much one-to-one down to what these enterprise customers and operators want or are using.
People that are resistant to this, the new model, open networking, Kyle, they often throw support in my face as one of the reasons. I can't get the kind of support I want, or I'm not sure which throat I'm going to have to choke to get an answer. So, you know, because they're uncomfortable with the support models as they perceive them, or they don't think there's any support, they don't want to look at open networking as a possible answer. What is the future of support in open networking, where we've got a disaggregated stack and different vendors involved in making it all go?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I think you're going to see there's a range here, you know, and on the one end, you have the hyperscalers and maybe larger enterprises, larger organizations that are able to kind of handle all of that support themselves by kind of organically building that type of organization. They have engineers, they have, you know, operators that are all trained, and they can do that. And on the far end, you have people that really just want to buy something. And so on that end, you could envision a future where you have something like Red Hat, where you have a company that's selling the open source, is working in open source on from a networking perspective, and they're selling it, and you get support from them, and you're running it. Now you could argue, does that look like more of a traditional vendor? In a lot of ways, it kind of does, but it is open source at the heart of that type of solution. And I think there's obviously a lot of middle ground in the middle as well, where maybe you're running some pieces of your infrastructure open and you have that support, but you're still using vendors for other things.
I definitely agree. I definitely agree that vendors have a part to play here. Now, hopefully it won't be the sort of part that they had to play in OpenStack, where they all loved it to death. They all left on it.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And we don't want that to happen again, right? I mean, that is something we should all try to prevent.
No. And that meant, you know, and the vendors really didn't understand. I think there are several lessons out of OpenStack that vendors took away. One is they now have an understanding of what open source is. They also, most big vendors only understand failure. They don't really understand their successes all that well. And when they fail, they actually learn something from it. And unfortunately, a lot of customers got burned as vendors, you know, because vendors aren't very self-aware and aren't very capable of understanding what's really happening. But at the same time, we need vendors. It's not going to be possible for everybody to roll their own Linux or to populate their own thing. We need parties who are going to maintain, like, look at Open Daylight. Pulling Open Daylight from source would be a very difficult thing to do. It's much better to go and buy it from Luminar, and they're doing all the packaging and the testing and the validation for you. Mm. You're still getting open source, and a vendor is doing all of the hard work for you to, you know, merge the patches upstream, get the support, you know, if you find a bug, make sure that gets upstreamed into the project, all that sort of stuff. Vendors have a role to play here, but their businesses are going to change, and that's very painful for most of them.
Now, the vendors have a role to play point is really important, Greg, in that I hear some people making the argument like, well, if you're a real network engineer, you're just going to get into the code and fix the problem yourself and write whatever module you need for your business and so on, which I think is unrealistic for a lot of companies.
But wouldn't it be great if everybody was based on the same open network Linux core or open switch core, whoever's core it is, right? And everybody's switch was 80% the same, but only 20% different, because every switch, every router, every networking device that we use for L3, L4 forwarding, and every networking device we use for security or load balancing or for inspection, they're all exactly the same. 80% of the functionality is the same. There's no reason to have, you know, Junos and Cisco's got 7 or 8, 12, 10, 15, 20 different iOS versions. Extreme's got three, you know, it's got how many versions now that it's a merger of Avaya and Brocade, and like that's pointless. There is no competitive advantage to be gained by having a different operating system on all of those switches. Really?
We keep cutting off Kyle. Kyle, you gotta be cringing at the moment considering who you work for.
Well, so I'll tell you, here's the other issue with all of this support things that gets lost in the noise, I think. So assume you are running your own, right? Now, if you're doing something like what you mentioned with Illumina or some other vendor that's supporting that, great, they're doing all the paying. But assume you want to do your own. So assume you're running Open Network Linux. And guess what? There's a CVE that's opened on the Linux kernel version that you have on your switches. What is your process to redeploy that and to get that running again? And I think most enterprises, you know, that is something you really have to think about. And that can be painful, certainly if you haven't thought about it. And it really comes down to, if you're going to go and run open infrastructure and open source software on this, you've got to be able to continuously integrate and deploy this stuff. You've got to have a CI/CD pipeline that can do this, even for your networking hardware. And I think that is, honestly, like that is an area where there's probably an opportunity for consulting and for help, because that's a huge change for a lot of these enterprises.
Yeah, okay. What you just said is really just struck me. So traditionally, network operators would look at a switch and say, I need to put new code on it. Okay, that means
right. You
know, downtime or something I got to be careful of. So I'm going to need a change window, and I'm going to swing traffic, and I'm going to load the new code. I'm going to reboot it. Then I'm going to go through a bunch of sanity checks. And that model would be broken in an open source networking model. You're saying we would need to have a CIC pipeline so that as changes to our open source networking software come in from the community, wherever they're coming in from, whatever that process would be, we can quickly onboard them, bring that code into production in our open source networks, and then so that things like, okay, we've got some major security bug that affects a lot of our boxes, we can quickly get patched and be confident that that's going to work. And the one device at a time, we're going to upgrade it during this maintenance window model, that just wouldn't work.
Right. And you can think about this. I mean, honestly, having a robust CI/CD pipeline, you know, that's filled with tests as code passes from development into production. I mean, really, organizations should be thinking about this regardless. And you can certainly do this even with vendor solutions on the one end. Take the example of you're using Ansible to automate your favorite vendor's switch, right? You should clearly have a CI/CD pipeline as you're changing that Ansible that's testing it along the way before you go and run it against the production switch. But when you move to something like an open switch where you're controlling, you're running Open Network Linux, open switch, whatever, or even your own custom Linux, now you have changes to that base operating system independent from maybe the control plane or the routing engine that you're using on there. And you really have to be able to continuously integrate and test these before you can deploy them. So I think that whole CI/CD pipeline is also something that enterprises really have to be able to grasp that, understand it, and kind of move to that model. And it's much like what we were discussing with the network operators. You know, most of them maybe like CLIs and are doing this. Well, now you really got to be able to understand how to continuously integrate all this stuff, test it along this pipeline before you deploy it. Becomes a challenge, I think.
And that's a substantial task. It's not something that that normal. Like nobody even does that for their Linux deployment.
It's a big operational change, but not insurmountable, Greg. If you in the first virtual design clinic, we had Matt Oswalt talk about basically this, and he did a simple illustration of how you would do CI/CD for firewall rule changes and what that would look like, and you know, built it up. I mean, he's really familiar with the tools, so he made it sound a little simpler than it would actually be for someone trying to get it off the ground. But still, he made it very approachable. Despite it being a big change.
And that's a great start, right? Because exactly what Matt was talking about, and I've seen this, and he's talked about this, given talks, that's the exact right approach, because that allows you to take your current infrastructure, whether it's whatever firewall in this particular case, whatever vendor you're using, and just automate the configuration for it, but test it along the way. Because that's the part that's usually missed in the automation step. Hey, we have automation, but unless it's also tested along the way continuously, and that testing automatically stops it from being propagated to production, you know, what is the point of the automation? You're just going to automate failure at that point.
And we often do.
Fail and scale.
Exactly. Fail and scale.
Yeah, that's exactly. The one. Mm. So, Kyle, what I want to do is I want to loop the conversation back around to some of the projects that we're seeing in the Linux Foundation now, and particularly the ones that were spawned by AT&T and Big Switch. That's Danos, Dinos, Stratum, and Open Networking Linux. Now, that to me looks a bit like the current path that open source is going to run down in terms of network operating systems on white box switches. Do you sort of have a sense about where that's going? And maybe what we should do is try and explain what the difference is between those four things.
Right. I think that that's actually a great question. And I think to start to answer that, I think we should, let's take a look back at the history of a lot of these companies, at how they've worked in open source. And let's look back at OpenStack Neutron, right? So when OpenStack was super hot and everyone was working from a networking perspective in there, you had Neutron, which was kind of this gating project, and everybody had to get stuff into there. And it was challenging. It was challenging for the people trying to get things in. It was challenging for the developers trying to stabilize it and ship it. It was challenging for them to try to enable a lot of these different vendors and operators while also working on the code and supporting the stuff upstream. So that model was very difficult. So I think what you've noticed now is a lot of them have stepped back and said, you know what, we're going to kind of do our own thing. And that's why you have AT&T with DNOS, which has kind of morphed into Danos. You have Big Switch with Open Network Linux. Dell's got Open Switch. You have all of these different things. You know, Microsoft has Sonic as well. And I think that's where it is. I think what the industry needs to do and what the ONF and the LF need to do is to try to figure out a way how to converge some of this stuff so that it's consumable and so that the enterprises and users can understand what all this is, because there's a lot of noise around this right now.
So what you're saying, so there's three things that I mentioned there: Danos, Stratum, and Open Network Linux. They're all operating systems for networking devices, well, both physical and virtual.
They're actually not, because Stratum, if you look at the press coverage around Stratum, it talks about operating system, but it looks to me like it's really a control plane. It's really not the operating system itself. And it runs on something like Open Network Linux, or it runs on some custom Linux that Google has or something like that. And that this is exactly where the confusion is. I think the messaging has been kind of bad around these things. And I think that all needs to tighten up. And in Stratum's case, you know, right now we can't look at the code either, right? The code isn't available, so we can't really go and see what's going on there.
Let's assume that Google releases what they said they were going to release. But these are operating systems for switches.
Yes.
And in some cases, not just operating systems, but also the apps that sit on top. So they are the routing protocols, the FPGA controllers, the power supply managers, the boot cycles for the operating, all that sort of stuff.
Correct. And I think that is where there is definitely a chance to kind of standardize on this. And because all of that you mentioned, hey, why are we all doing different things to do that? Why are we all either writing our drivers for that or just packaging the same driver differently? So I think that definitely is a chance. And honestly, that's where I would like to see ONL, the lower bits of Sonic from what Microsoft has, and OpenSwitch, like, coalesce around that layer. Come up with maybe a common Linux, common packages of some sort that does that. So then you can build your secret sauce control plane on top, or just use, you know, FR routing for BGP on top and something like that. I think that makes the whole thing more consumable for people and would seem like a logical place to go.
I think there should just be one NOS. It shouldn't be like Danos, Stratum, ONL, because, and I understand where we are, right? It's fine. But really, we need just one, whether it's virtual device or a physical device. It's the same fundamental concept. You know, when you load Linux, there's really only a couple of different ways to boot a Linux instance, right? They all run the same bootloader. They all run the same way. After that, it gets messy. You might choose to run NPM or, you know, Apache or Nginx or, you know, as a web server or any one of 100. But at least the core of Linux is more or less the same. And yes, there's some variations in there. And maybe what happens is you have a Cisco version of an open NOS that you choose to buy, or maybe it's a Brocade or a Juniper one that you choose to buy. And then you choose which apps go on top of that. Now, whether you buy and I think this is, and like, I think what you're trying to say here is that this is a step down that path. Bring all the open source projects together and then see where the convergence can happen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think that's it, right? Because like I was saying, if you look at the OpenStack model, we started with that convergence and then we tried to like pull things apart, and that was messy, caused a lot of pain. I think now it seems like we've started disaggregated open source projects. Well, now I think it might be time this year and into 2019 to see where we can kind of converge some of those and still allow things to kind of blossom, you know, allow different people to have their own projects, their different control planes, whatever they want around some of this. So I think that's what you'll see. I think the ONF and the LF will spend some time this year trying to do that. I think it's in the operator's interest as well. It's certainly in the enterprise's interest there as well.
And is there any, you know, vendor competition where there's money at stake or something, that there's going to be resistance to such a unification?
Sure. I mean, I think definitely, right? Because the vendors all have their own switches and their own operating systems there as well. But I mean, ultimately, a lot of those are Linux based or FreeBSD based or whatever, right? They're different open source already underneath, right? So to some extent, even a lot of the vendor solutions are part of this kind of disaggregation on the bottom of as far as like all these different versions of Linux and things like that. So.
But you mentioned, I think we're in a different position now than we were 5 years ago when open source networking was just ejected out of hand by all parts of the market. Vendors weren't going to have anything to do with it. Customers weren't going to have anything to do with it. We didn't have public cloud really 5 years ago. And now all of a sudden things are very different. We didn't do software overlays. Software wasn't talked about in the networking concept. It was always like, oh yeah, no, I just have to pay for a software license and I get my mainframe switch. I think it's very different now, and this feels like it's much more likely to be a sustained movement over time. I don't want to make a prediction here, but I do feel like it's different now because we've seen the success of and the failures of some open source projects, and yet we're still engaging and still going forward.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I agree. It seems like people have learned from the past 5 years. They've kind of figured that out. And you know, like you said, I think people kind of learn from failure as well as they learn from success. And I think that's what we'll see. Now, you know, we can try to predict where we're going to be in 3 or 5 years, and who knows if we'll be right. But it certainly seems like there's enough interest and kind of growth in open source networking, you know, both from operators, users, developers, that it's definitely here to stay. It'll be interesting to see where it goes over the next 3 to 5 years.
I have a theory that service providers are likely to actually go through this innovation cycle first rather than enterprises. Would you agree or disagree, and why?
I would agree. I think that's the case. I think they have more incentive, from a capital and a cost perspective. And I think they also have more incentive from a developer perspective. They have more resources to pull in more developers to educate their operators and that. So it definitely seems like that's the case.
And to work through the pain, I guess. It's like if you're building a $20 billion, like Verizon, I think, spends $20 billion in capital a year. And if you think you can save $200 million, then you can easily spend $10 million trying to get that $200 million saving and justify that, I think.
Exactly. And that's where it is. And I think that's why you're likely to see the service providers continue to kind of drag that forward, with maybe the enterprise riding the tail of that innovation.
You know what? I was just thinking about that. I actually think what will happen is the service providers will push it forward to the point where it becomes practical. And then all of a sudden the enterprises will jump onto it because their change cycle is less than a service provider.
Yeah, right. So in other words, they're going to get the benefit without having to do a lot of the upfront work.
Which is just going to be like, you know, the big company pushes the whole project forward, builds the momentum. And then all of a sudden the enterprise goes, ooh, that looks like it's ready for me to use. And because they're not on 10-year rotation, you know, 10 to 20-year ownership cycles or refresh cycles, they can suddenly say, oh, we'll start sucking that in. But that would be a positive, loop, because then that would generate revenue and profits, and the vendors would and customers in a virtuous cycle that would accelerate that move away into the open source world, which is really a world of choice.
Exactly. Yeah, it would be interesting to see that, and I actually could see that happening as well.
A world of choice. I'm trying to ponder how many enterprises actually want that, but anyway.
Choice is good until it's not, right? I mean, I don't remember where I heard that, but it's true, right? I mean, you know, choice can paralyze a lot of these organizations as well.
Yeah, I think so. But I do also feel people are happy to have choice taken away from them in the sense that hyperconverged is going to is booming at a substantial rate. But we can also start thinking about how hyperconverged can let us access networking functions in a completely different way. So instead of relying on, you know, fairly fixed, static, slow moving, like, you know, if you look at Cisco's ACI SDN for Australia, it's very slow. It doesn't innovate. It doesn't change. Its ability to adopt service chains or network functions virtualization is limited by the way, you know, design decisions that were made 10 years ago. And it doesn't kind of flex to some of the things that we're talking about. It's not very well suited to service mesh. I'm sure it can be adapted over time, but it's not well suited to it. So, you know, the fact that you can now build a hyperconverged platform and suddenly start taking on these new open source products instead of doing the others, you could just tick off you go and build it in, and the functions are there, and you don't have to go and get a custom switch build or a custom operating system build to test out these networking things. They're just a piece of software that runs in a container, and you snap them into your hyperconverged platform.
Right, and I think that's containers kind of provide that. Containers are providing that chance, I think, to kind of insert a different way of doing a lot of this. And I think that people will take advantage of that for sure.
Hmm. I think we've reached the end.
I do think the end. we each pausing at the end, pondering, going,
we're all kind of like, I know we're thinking like, what do we think next now? No, but this was great. I feel like this was really, really pretty good. I hope you guys do too.
Well, we do. This was a good conversation and one that was great to share with everybody, Kyle. And you're very public and out there in the socials. You blog and so on. Would you share with people how they can follow you, Kyle?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So if people want to get a hold of me, I have a blog. It is blog.siliconloons.com. And then I am also on Twitter at Mestery, M-E-S-T-E-R-Y. So those are the best ways to get a hold of me. And I love engaging with people on Twitter as well. So definitely hit me up there.
I'm Ethan Banks and Greg Farrell. We were your co-hosts today. And thanks to you for listening to Packet Pushers. You can find this and many more of our fine, absolutely free technical podcasts, along with our community blog. That's engineers like you writing up their solutions and observations about the industry. And that's all at packetpushers.net. Tweet to us at Packet Pushers. You can follow us on LinkedIn. And if you would, take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts. I know it's like an effort. You got to like pull up the rating thing and all that stuff. Take a minute and do it. It really would boost our ratings in Apple Podcasts, which means more people can discover our little network here. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.